Welcome to the CREXI Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI and today's host. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that cater to both commercial real estate newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI. And today we are thrilled to sit down with Matthew Burke, founder and CEO of Fairway America and Verivest. A little bit about our guest. Matt Burke is a seasoned real estate executive, chief investment officer, and fund manager who started and managed 11 real estate asset-based Reg D pooled investment funds over 30 plus years. He's also worked as a discretionary underwriter and approval authority of thousands of real estate asset-based investments with a total asset value in the billions, including pooled investment funds, real estate secured loans, syndications, participations, GP and LP equity interests, and more. As a real estate asset-based 506 Regulation D pooled investment fund expert, Matt has played lead roles in advising on the architecture and creation of hundreds of discretionary pooled funds for hundreds of sponsors, private lenders, and managers across multiple real estate strategies and asset types, including debt, equity, GP co-invest, multifamily, office, industrial, retail, self-storage, hospitality, residential, construction, value add, mortgage pools, distressed debt acquisition, tax lien certificates, single family rental, fix and flip, B2R, and much, much more. Matt is also the author of Capital Attraction, the Small Balance Real Estate Entrepreneur's Essential Guide to Raising Capital, and the host of Fundamentals with Matt Burke. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Yannis. That was a mouthful, man. If I'd have known we were going to go through all of that, I probably would have given you a much shorter version of it.
Is there anything you haven't done in this space yet?
Yeah, I don't know, man. That's, like I said, I'd have given you a shorter one. So thanks for going through all of that. But, you know, but yeah, I guess all that really says is I've been doing it for a long time.
Well, I know we've covered some of your background, of which, you know, there's a lot to cover, but I'd love to briefly hear a little more about your career path and some lessons learned along the way. Can you tell us about where you're from and how you started in commercial real estate and investing?
Yeah, I grew up in California. I kind of got into it by accident out of school, you know, graduated in economics. And I went to work for a finance company that did real estate, you know, second mortgages and so forth. And that's really where I, you know, first got involved in it. Worked in a number of lending institutions for 5 or 6 years before I started my own company, but really just got started in real estate finance and, you know, kind of cut my teeth that way. And it's been a long journey ever since. But yeah, it all started in sort of consumer finance with a real estate, you know, wrapper.
So Matt, what about commercial real estate initially drew you in? What were some of the challenges and what came easily to you?
Yeah, I think, well, early on, I was really doing a lot more residential real estate, but I think commercial was much more interesting. It's just got a lot more moving parts to it. It's more sophisticated. You know, there's more components to driving, you know, what the value is of a piece of property. So I think that's really what kind of drew me in, was it was just more intriguing, more interesting. You know, like I said, more moving parts. So that part was interesting. I mean, the challenges, obviously different asset classes have different value drivers, you know, the way in which you look at property, different real estate has different, you know, managerial components. Some are more operationally oriented, some are less. So, you know, there's just a lot of differences, and it's always fascinating to me, Yannis, how many different ways there are to make money in commercial real estate, how many different strategies there are. So I think the variety of it and the, you know, the intellectual challenge of it is just kind of what drew me in and what's kept me going for a long time.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. You know, the longer I do this, the more varied ways I hear about how, you know, people make money with commercial real estate. Are there any strategies that really, you know, surprised you or really impressed you the first time that kind of stuck with you?
Well, you know, there's always the normal ones that you hear about that a lot of people do, but I'd say in the business that we're in, which I know we'll get to here in a little bit, but setting up funds for other people, I've heard, I mean, hundreds of different strategies that people have come up with, and some have been pretty wacky and some have been pretty fascinating and unique. Some people think are unique, but actually there's a whole bunch of people doing it. So I mean, I'd say some of the more interesting ones, I mean, we've had people, you know, building self-storage facilities out of shipping containers. You know, we've had people trying to set up a fund to build ADU out of prefab boxes. You know, we've had converting large big box into storage and other types of facilities. So there's all kinds of ways that people have an idea of how to, you know, get in and make money on the buy and convert it or do something with it. So, I mean, the variety is more or less endless.
And, you know, variety is really an appropriate word when talking about your career because, you know, you've really approached a lot of different product types and the market from many different angles. How did you approach transitions in your lines of work through each project? And, you know, how did skills learned in one, you know, career help you succeed in the next?
Yeah, I think sometimes necessity is the mother of invention, right? So a large part of what got me into what we're doing today is coming out of the Great Recession. I'd say in the early days when I started the company, I would characterize this as more of a one-trick pony. We were hard money lenders, right? We made loans secured by commercial, and we focused on commercial because it was harder for people to get financing if they didn't meet the bank criteria. You know, residential became, you know, back in those days, all of the whole subprime lending and all that, it became easier and easier to get money. And that just never made sense to me. So commercial was more attractive to us. I think coming out of the Great Recession, we were sort of forced into a position where we had to wind down a fund. And in the process of that wind down, I mean, I learned a tremendous amount as a practitioner on, you know, and I made all the mistakes, Giannis, of you know, that today I try to help people avoid making a lot of the same mistakes I made. But, you know, it was a lot of it was out of necessity to find a business model that worked. And I just leveraged the experiences that I had to help other people learn from those experiences and hopefully accelerate their success.
As an entrepreneur, what motivated you to transition from to syndication?
We were a lender mostly, so we would raise money from private investors. We would place one deal at a time with that investor, and we would do the servicing. I think moving from debt to equity was something that we did in the early 2010s. And a lot of that was, there was a lot of opportunity at that point, and we knew a lot of people that wanted to set up funds that were doing things other than just lending money. So that was really what drove us into the equity space. And then we ended up doing a lot of syndications, you know, from there. But I've made loans secured by development projects over the years, but we've never really been huge into the development space. I mean, done a fair amount of redevelopment of existing stuff over the last 10 years or so. But yeah, it's, you know, it's been an evolution, and sometimes you don't know why or how things are going to take you in the direction that they do. But that's part of being an entrepreneur, right? Is identifying the opportunity and being open to it.
Taking risk. I'm curious, who are some of your mentors and how did they shape your career path either early or later in your career?
Yeah, I think on the real estate side, largely folks that I worked for and with early on in my career and names that people probably never heard of. But just, you know, folks that helped me understand how to look at real estate and think about it, I would say perhaps probably more impactful for me personally and business wise is a lot of, I've devoted a lot of time in my life to personal development. I think Earl Nightingale was an early, mentor, even though I never met the guy. I mean, he produced a lot of, he was called the Dean of Personal Development, but he had a lot of audio programs back in the, you know, these were audio cassettes, and that dates me there, Giannis. But, Earl Nightingale and Jim Rohn and Brian Tracy and a lot of those type of names that influenced a lot of my early belief system around, you know, the habits that it takes to be successful. And then over time, I've listened to thousands of audio programs and too many names to mention, but those are some of the ones that influenced me early on.
And as far as that personal development goes, you know, is there anybody that you're listening to now, any podcasts or publishers that, you keep up with and, you know, continue on with personal development?
Yeah, I've listened to a lot of variety of stuff on Audible, a lot of audio books. I do listen to a fair amount of podcasts. I mean, sometimes it's business and commercial real estate related. And one of my favorite commercial real estate ones is the Walker webcast, Wally Walker, the CEO of Walker and Dunlop. He's fantastic material there. I was listening to one this morning on Spotify, but just completely, you know, not related to business, but just, you know, learning about things. It was a sort of a biography on Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, and that was a fascinating story that I actually had never really paid a lot of attention to or knew all that much about. But kind of a wide variety of things that I listen to and like, and just, you know, mostly it's about continuing to just educate myself on things that I find interesting.
Now, what were some lessons that you learned early on that became invaluable going forward? And did you have any favorite mistakes, let's call them, or moments that course corrected you onto your current path that at the time you didn't recognize as opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the biggest lesson early on in real estate is to really understand the value drivers of the property, right? Especially as a lender, when you're lending money, and particularly if you're lending hard money, where the borrower may have a, you know, more difficult time with the repayment, or certainly not as traditional as a bank loan, you really have to pay attention to what the value of the property is. So I learned early on not to just accept at face value what an appraiser might say a property is worth, but to actually do our own homework and really understand what the value of that real estate, you know, was and is. And that's really driven a lot of my thinking around becoming, you know, so you've heard the old saying, you make money on the buy in real estate, right? I mean, it's like, if you mess up when you buy it, you pay too much, it's hard to recover, right? If you buy it right, you can generally overcome, you know, some mistakes, you know, or some challenges or issues along the way. So getting in at the right number has always been, you know, a huge driver of our decision making from an underwriting standpoint, really from the beginning. You know, in terms of challenges along the way, I mean, I think, again, the Great Recession, our fund at the time had a large credit facility with Wells Fargo Capital Finance at the time, and the recession sort of put them out of that business, and they wouldn't renew the line, even though we were, you know, far and away above our debt cover and never missed a payment and never had a problem. But when all of a sudden you have a credit facility that you have to pay back and you've got equity that's subordinated to that, it's a lot like in any business. If you put too much credence into one supplier, it's kind of an all or nothing proposition, right? So that was a big challenge along the way that had a big impact on some of the changes that we made going forward.
Moving along on our talk track, now that we have a more complete understanding of your story and background, why don't we discuss what your company does and market perspectives? Could you explain what Fairway America and Verivest do and their goals?
Yeah, well, I'd say we have three basic things that we provide. Our clientele or our target audience, Giannis, is real estate operators, entrepreneurs, syndicators, you know, private lenders, anybody who is doing real estate deals using other people's money. That's our target audience. And what we provide for them is help launching their own pooled investment fund. So if you're a syndicator or a single asset, real estate asset-based manager, and you want to put in a pooled investment fund, that's what Fairway and Verivest do. And we provide three basic things: advisory, administration, and capital. So basically, the starting point oftentimes is we help them set up and structure that fund in the first place. We do the back office accounting and administration for that fund, so track all of the income allocations and so forth. And then Fairway is on the investment side. We use that as an origination channel for us to identify investment opportunities to invest in the manager entities to help them grow and scale. So it's an integrator, two separate companies. Verivest is basically a services company, advisory and administration. Fairway is an investment company, you know, providing capital to these managers to help them grow. But combined, you know, they're very integrated. They feed off of each other. And that's really what we do for those managers, advisory, admin, capital.
And for our listeners that may not be so familiar, can you touch on what syndication is?
Yeah, I define a syndication as a deal where the manager, the real estate professional, is raising capital from investors to acquire a single asset, right? So you might buy a piece of property, whatever it is, an apartment building or retail office, industrial, whatever, right? And you need to raise $5 million in equity. They're pulling in that $5 million from a variety of investors, might be 10, 20, 30 investors, and so that they're syndicating that deal, right? They're bringing in money and they're putting them into an entity and then acquiring that one piece of property with the money from those investors. So syndication is multiple investors coming into an entity that is buying a single asset.
And what is involved with setting up a real estate investment fund? You know, what are the pros and cons of creating one?
Yeah, well, then a fund would be multiple assets and multiple investors, right? So as opposed to bringing in investors to buy a single asset, now you're bringing in investors into an entity that intends to buy multiple assets. So it is an order of magnitude more complicated, because you have to track all of the, you know, investors coming in and out at various points in time, assets coming in and out, you know, how do they interact with each other? How do you accumulate and allocate that income? It's a considerably more complicated vehicle structure than a single asset syndication. So, you know, it's a deep subject, Giannis, and there's no, you know, quick or short answer, but I'd say if I just super high level, I mean, there's no one right way to do it. Sometimes syndications are better for certain managers and certain investors, and sometimes funds are better. It really depends on the manager, it depends on the investor, it depends on their objectives, depends on their, you know, number of deals they're doing, the velocity of those deals, the size of those deals, the amount of capital they need. You know, from an investor standpoint, there's differences, right? I mean, it's more diversified in a fund as opposed to being in one asset, but you don't get to pick and choose. You know, the manager picks and chooses, not the investor. Whereas in a syndication, the investor can look and see, hey, I like that deal or I don't. So lots of differences, lots of pluses and minuses on either side. No one perfect or absolute, you know, way to go.
Right. And I suppose, you know, choosing one over the other is really going to kind of depend on, you know, the deal or the manager, right? You know, if it's a manager that you trust and, you know, they have great taste in putting, you know, a fund together, or they have, you know, proven success, you may opt to go with a fund versus, you know, maybe you've got more specific knowledge about a specific, you know, product type or a market, and,
that's right,
you know, a syndication might be a better fit for you.
Yeah, that's right. And even other things too. In a syndication, you know, your money's tied up in a deal, and then if you get the money back, you got to reinvest it. You know, some people prefer to just let the manager reinvest it, stays invested in a fund. You know, there's open-ended funds that have redemption mechanisms. There's closed-ended funds that don't. There's all kinds of strategies for different funds. So, you know, there's just a lot, as I said early in the discussion here, there's just a lot of variety and a lot of options. There's no one right way to do it. For everybody, a lot really depends on what an investor is trying to accomplish. And from a manager standpoint, you know, should they do a fund? Should they not do a fund? You know, that's a conversation I have all the time with clients is, you know, why would I do a fund or not do a fund? Well, you know, what makes sense? What doesn't make sense? It's very much an individual thing depending on a variety of factors that don't necessarily apply to everybody.
Right. How does Fairway America strategize your investments? You know, what do you consider when evaluating different asset classes or markets as acquisition targets?
Yeah, I would say for us, I'd say the jockey is the most important thing, right? We're mostly looking at who is the manager, who is the group, who are the people. Obviously, we look at their strategy and try to get our mind around it and make sure we agree with the thesis of whatever it is. But I would say that we're not necessarily targeting managers that do one specific thing. You know, from a Verivest perspective, from an advisory and an admin perspective, if we're not making the investment, right, we'll help. You know, the clients can be all over the map. From a fairway perspective, we're looking at who's the manager, how long have they been doing it, what kind of a track record do they have, can they prove that track record, how good will they be at raising capital? Because a big part of the success is being able to actually grow and scale. And I'd say one of the hardest things to do, Giannis, in a pooled investment fund is raise the money. I mean, raising money is hard enough in a syndication, but in a pooled investment fund, I mean, like the threshold goes up, right? Because the manager or the investor is now trusting the manager to pick and choose, right? So one of the things we look for is, do we think this manager is going to be successful raising money? You know, and can we help this manager raise money? I mean, we don't do it for them, but we certainly provide all of the strength of the resources that we've got in our own experiences to try to help the managers that come through be successful, because of course we benefit if they, you know, they benefit, we benefit, everyone benefits if they're good at raising money. So it's less about the asset type and more about the manager. That said, you know, there's certainly, we have asset types we like better than others, right? I'd rather be in multifamily and industrial and storage than say office or hospitality or whatever. Not that, but hey man, I know office and hospitality managers that are extremely good at what they do. Yeah. So I might even consider it under the right set of circumstances, right? In those asset classes, we have the right manager.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like personalities and expertise kind of trump most other things. You know, if somebody really knows the product that they're working with, really knows the market that they're working in, and you know, you have faith in their ability to, you know, manage and you know, find returns, you know, based on their thesis, then that's really more important than anything else.
Yeah, and I would use a couple of other words and say character and competence are super high on the list. You know, if they have good character and they have good competence and they can demonstrate that, then, you know, generally speaking, they're going to be successful.
I'm curious, what's an immediate disqualifier for you that you've, you know, maybe something was interesting and then, you know, a personality trait stuck out and you said, nope, that's a hard pass for me.
I think people that think they got everything figured out, that have no room for improvement, or, you know, you can tell pretty quick, right, with certain people that just, they don't have any appreciation or have any belief system of wanting to do continual improvement. They got it all figured out. That's generally a pretty quick turnoff. I think if we catch them in lies, that's a huge, you know, red flag. I've had lots of people that say they've done something, and then when you ask them to prove it, they simply can't. You know, it's frankly remarkable to me how often that happens and how little that, in the high net worth space especially, it's really hard to, I mean, it's easy to go out there and say you've done something. It's a lot harder to prove it. So, you know, I ask people point blank. It's like, hey, you know, you can make whatever statement representation you want. And look, I'll take it at face value if we're in Verivest, because I'm not making an investment, right? We'll help you and all that. But if we're going to make an investment, then you need to prove it. And, you know, sometimes they go away pretty quick when you ask them to do that. But so, yeah, those are some that come to mind.
Shifting gears a bit, I'd love to understand more about your perspective on current market happenings. You know, as someone who sets up hundreds of funds, or who's set up hundreds of funds over your career, can you provide us with a 30,000 foot overview of the real estate market as you see it now?
Super challenging. you know, rates have gone way up. Standoff between buyers and sellers. You know, people trying to hold on to not liquidate in a market where the capital markets are basically frozen, right? Everybody's waiting for the screaming deal, and so the sellers are holding on by their fingernails when they have to. You know, if you got fixed rate debt, you're in a pretty good position. If you're in certain asset types, you're in a pretty good position. But I mean, I've read various statistics, but you know, deal volume is down by what, 75%? I mean, I've seen it as something between 60 and 90, but it's a lot, right? So market's very challenging at the moment. I think people are very anxious to get back into the market, but until interest rates kind of calm down and people get a sense of you know, where they're going to level off at. I think you're going to just continue to see depressed volume and a challenging market. But good real estate's good real estate, right? I think it stands the test of time. And I think once the market unfreezes a little bit, I think you'll start to see activity come back. Is that this year? Maybe second half of the year, maybe it's into 24. But I think it's just going to be slow for a while.
Who are you seeing break formation currently? Is it more buyers that are stepping up, or is it sellers that are letting go?
I think you're going to see sellers let go before you're seeing buyers step up. I think good real estate, you know, you still have, depending on who the buyers are, I mean, 1031 buyers, right? They have more other considerations, so they're not afraid to pay, you know, higher prices. I mean, we've seen a few. The transactions that we have seen here recently have been more in that realm, right? It's good, solid cash flowing real estate, either with good debt on it that can be assumed or buyers that are coming in that are willing to pay the higher price. But it depends on the situation. I really haven't seen, the dam break on either side yet. I think there's still a kind of a standoff in that area, but at least in our world, and I would make sure I'd characterize it, Giannis. We're in, I'd call it the sub institutional space generally. So these are smaller assets. These aren't the huge, you know, 100 million plus trophy properties. These might be 10, 20, 30 million dollar, you know, properties with $5-10 million equity checks, and you know, relatively small for the big institutions, but generally too big for the, you know, individual buyer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just speaking anecdotally, coming from our auction platform, I have noticed that more frequently recently we are seeing sellers willing to meet the market versus, buyers mm-hmm. really, you know, pushing each other up to seller expectations. And that's both on the institutional side and on the private client side. So,
yeah, I would agree with that. I would, as I said, if I had to say one or the other, my prediction would be it's going to be more sellers capitulating than it is buyers stepping up in the short run. But then you know how it goes too. It's like once the buyers jump back in, I mean, it can get frothy and competitive in a hurry because people are, you know, there's lots of people with allocations and money to put out that are just waiting to get it done. That are, you know, they want to steal. So.
Right. Right.
I suspect that's how it's going to go down.
But then you also run into the problem, most of these buyers that, you know, are buying an auction or doing it with cash want to apply some sort of debt instrument after acquiring it. And, you know, even when you have, you know, the cash to buy, it's not been easy for, you know, people to even obtain debt, even at, you know, where rates are currently. Can you talk a little bit about how not only the higher cost of debt contributing to participation in real estate funds is affecting it, but also, you know, lenders' willingness to actually lend?
Yeah, no, there's a palpable reduction in lender interest, you know, an increase in interest rates, a lowering in advance rates, which means you got to have more equity, you know, than you did before. So the combination of all that, of course, drives the price down, because how do you generate returns when you have, you know, lower advance rate, higher interest rates? That's the only way to do it. So, there's the availability of debt has gotten vastly harder in the last year. I haven't really seen that abating yet. I have seen quite a number of our clients who are debt oriented funds that are putting funds together to go out and provide debt financing. You know, not the cheapest debt financing in the world. So if you're the borrower, right, it's a tough time frame, you know, right now. So it's helping, I would say, on the fund client side, people that want to get in and become lenders. And it's hurting if you're a borrower.
Right. And, you know, where do you see opportunities amid these changing market conditions? You know, has this opened the path for new strategies that, you know, you're taking into consideration that might be more attractive now than they've ever been?
Yeah, I've seen some interesting strategies around, homeowners, for example, people that are, buying property or leveraging assets where people already have super low locked in interest rates. I mean, that's a pretty fascinating strategy that seems super interesting. You know, I've seen, I've seen a bunch of lenders that are coming out and setting up, you know, pooled investment funds. I've seen Multifamily, I think, is still a pretty good opportunity, particularly on the lower end where, more affordable type housing that you're seeing. I think senior living is an attractive asset class that looks like it's going to just continue to, the demographics are very much in favor of that, type of asset class. And it doesn't seem to be as affected by some of the debt issues as some other asset classes. So there's pockets of it. I think, again, we really lead with the advisory work and the admin work and then let that drive what our investment, options might look like. So you're seeing continue to see a wide variety of stuff. Some of it very interesting, some of it pretty vanilla.
How about office? I know office has been getting beat up pretty bad, and really every conversation I've had around office, it seems like the outlook looks a little bit more bleak. But there are some people that feel really strongly that office is really poised and set for, resurgence and to come back strong as, work from home seems to not be as effective as, workforces that are in an office, collaborating, working together. And then you've got, it seems like a lot of interested parties really going aggressively after some, adaptive reuse projects on office. Do you see some upside there?
I have seen some people going after the adaptive reuse on office. So I've feel like that's a tough, reusing office for other purposes in my experience has been harder than some other asset class, repurposing like big boxes. That's fairly easy. Even hospitality conversion and the multi, we've done quite a bit of that. Haven't done a whole lot of the office, adaptive reuse. I think in a lot of ways, and this is true not just with office, but there is no one thing in real estate, right? There is no one real estate market. There is a lot of micro markets. So if you take office as an example, downtown Class A office in a lot of major CBDs is hurting. And I don't see that coming back anytime soon. But suburban office, like out where we are, in more flex style, single, everybody has their own space with their own, separate bathroom and so forth, that they're killing it and close to 100% occupied, and rents are as high as they've ever been. So it kind of depends on what type of office someone's looking at, I think, in terms of the drivers. And that's true on all real estate types. So, we would look at office under the right set of circumstances. Just kind of depends on what it is and what are people doing with it.
What makes office particularly difficult for adaptive reuse compared to other products? Is it simply just how they're built and how the systems are constructed?
Yeah, how they're built, the internal systems, the HVAC, the floor plates, the way they're, the interior setbacks, the lack of windows, et cetera. It's just it's a more difficult building to try to convert into something else based on a lot of the requirements and the way that building was built, depending on what it is.
Got it. Well, given your background and expertise, I'm sure our listeners would be curious about your answers to a few rapid fire questions and words of advice. You ready?
Sure.
So if you were given $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would be your go-to asset type, location, and why?
Yeah, I think for us, we would put it in the best managers that we could get that had the best strategies that we judge. So I wouldn't pick one. If I had to pick one, it's probably multi, because I feel like that's most liquid and most stands the test of time. But we spread it out, 50 million, probably spread it under 10 managers and pick different parts of the country and different strategies on the 10 best managers I could find.
All right. Favorite tool or software you use on the job? And I promise this is not a trick question.
Favorite tool or software? Well, my laptop goes everywhere I go. So that's the number one thing. Software, a variety of different tools that we use, HubSpot, ClickUp, different ways to run the company, our Verivest in there quite a bit on our platform. So, variety of stuff. But the laptop is the go-to, wouldn't leave home without it.
And what's the most common misconception about your job or industry?
Most common misconception about, my job, particularly as CEO, if anybody thinks it's easy, But I'm not sure how many people think that. I don't know about the industry. I think the people, we have interns in our office right now, and it's interesting to hear young people coming in the commercial real estate space that have preconceived notions about what it is. And then they see all the stuff that we do and it kind of blows their mind. And it's just, I think it's that if anybody thinks that there's just one way, that's absolutely incorrect. There's just there's a thousand ways to do things in the commercial real estate space. And so the variety is virtually limitless.
And, you know, if you could recommend one book to our listeners out there to, and it doesn't necessarily need to be about commercial real estate, just to help people, you know, advance themselves, some sort of self-improvement, what would you recommend?
Well, probably my favorite all-time piece of work was Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Classic and timeless, fantastic. There's another book called Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play by a guy named Mahan Khalsa, which is ostensibly a sales book, but it's really about communication, you know, how to deal with other people. And it's fabulous material. Those are two. I mean, I've got dozens that I could recommend, but in terms of just, you know, human effectiveness, those are two at the top of the list.
Fantastic. I appreciate the recommendations. As we wrap up, any parting words you'd like to share with our audience?
If you're thinking about a career in commercial real estate, it's fascinating. It's endless. If you're thinking about setting up a fund, you know, be careful, make a good decision. Obviously love to help them. I just encourage people in the real estate space to learn as much as you can learn. And there's an endless number of things to learn. So lifelong learning goes a long way and opens up a lot of opportunities.
Well, Matt, thank you for joining us and sharing your insights. I know you're very busy and, you know, we appreciate you spending time to sit down with us in the audience. Where can people find you online if they want to get in touch? Email, social media?
Yeah, LinkedIn is a great spot. Maybe go to my LinkedIn profile. You can always reach out to our website. It's fairwayamerica.com or verivest.com. Reach out that way. You know, those would be the best ways to get a hold of me.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexi.com/podcast. That's go.crexi.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexi podcast on your favorite podcast app or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexi for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, we'll see you next time.